So the first lecture I gave was, right in the morning, we were all awake, ready to attack this week. Now we're just after lunch, we're halfway through, you're a little bit exhausted, your brain is full, and yet we're going to talk about the standard model. And in particular, I want to highlight some of the features that have come up in my lunchtime conversations, and hopefully share some of those thoughts with everyone. So thanks everyone for your awesome questions. Please keep them coming, but know that we have to finish on time. Why? Because Giorgio is going to give us a colloquium at 2 o'clock. So we need to finish 2 minutes before the hour. So I'm going to keep us strictly on time. And so if I cut you off your questions, I'm really, really sorry. And we can talk over more of it over coffee. So let me just remind you where we were last time. I built the standard model in some sense a backwards way that maybe you've heard about it before, because I started off the standard model by talking about gravity, which we often don't think about as being part of the standard model. But in the context of taking very seriously the ideas of quantum mechanics, unitarity, locality, causality, if you say that the universe includes one massless spin two boson, then you immediately have general relativity coming out as a consequence. We also talked about if we have some number of massless spin one particles, you end up getting Yang-Mills theory, which then can couple to appropriately chosen conserved currents. And in terms of talking about spin a half and spin zero particles, we basically said that they were kind of unconstrained, unconstrained-ish. That is, they have to carry appropriate charges to couple to these massless spin one, and they have to have a stress energy tensor to talk to GR. But other than that, more or less anything goes, though there are some constraints which I'm happy to tell you about. So again, this is a consequence of deep principles. And if you want to break those principles, great. But know what the consequences are. And part of the consequences are that you don't get these things for free, and then you have to explain from some alternate set of principles why these things arise in our universe. With this, we built quantum electrodynamics. That's called coming from one massless spin one particle, coupling to electron and conjugate electron field or positron fields. And today we're actually going to build the standard model. And two things that came up repeatedly over my lunchtime conversations were one about understanding the Higgs mechanism and why the Higgs mechanism is so important. So we're going to talk about that. And then talking about the standard model as an effective field theory that created some lots of interest. But this means that there's all sorts of fun things on the cutting room floor. So I'm only going to touch on very briefly on the strong CP problem, nothing about EDMs or flavor physics, anomaly cancellation, unification, RG flow, confinement. Like this, as I said before, the standard model deserves more than 2 hours. But hopefully I'll give you something to mull over with the diving deeper on these topics. And if you gave me 2 more hours, we could talk about some other things. And again, happy to talk about these things offline. Okay, so we're going to start by building the standard model. And I want to start where we were last time with QED and remind you about these fields. So again, we have our massless spin two graviton, which comes with one free parameter, the Newton constant. We have, as I mentioned before, 12 massless spin one bosons. And those 12 massless spin one bosons organize themselves into a 1, a 3, and an 8, corresponding to the gauge groups of U1 hypercharge, SU2 left, and SU3 color. So these gauge groups have adjoint representations of 1, 3, and 8. And by the rules that we learned before, if you have massless spin one particles, you have to basically construct a gauge theory out of it. And you have three couplings associated with that: the hypercharge gauge coupling, the weak coupling, and the strong coupling. And then we have three copies of 15 spin a half Weyl fermions. And again, this 15 is a weird number. And these 15 spin a half Weyl fermions better interact appropriately with these gauge fields. And this table here will be telling you how they interact. So in QED, we had the electron and the conjugate field. So this is the left-handed electron. Its complex conjugate is right-handed positron. This is the right-handed electron and the complex conjugate left-handed positron. But actually, there's an asymmetry because of the weak force that says that the electron is paired up with a neutrino to make a lepton doublet. That lepton doublet has transformation properties under this SU2. And we treat the EC field and E field in a different way. So this is intrinsically parity violating, and so parity violation is built into the structure of the standard model. One of my areas of specialty is the strong force, SU3 color, and we have quarks charged under the strong force, but the U and D, they get paired up together into a doublet under the strong force. The other fields, the ones with this superscript C, they don't talk to the strong force. And then the quarks, there's three copies of them, and those three copies allow them to interact with these eight gluons via the strong force. So these are so-called three bar states, and this is three. And so we can add this up. We have 1 + 2 + 3 + 3 + 2 × 3, that's 6, and this should be 15. And again, we have three copies of this for the three generations of fermions. Then there's this U1 field, kind of like ENM, but not quite. So in ENM, the EC field, basically has the charge of a positron, so +1. But then we have weirdo hypercharge assignments for the doublet field. You might have heard that up quarks have charged 2/3. This is the conjugate field, so that's charged -2/3, +1/3 for DC. And then this doublet has this funny hypercharge of 1/6. And having specified this, I have given you the spin 2, spin 1, and spin 1/2 content of the standard model. And at this point, we still only have these four degrees of freedom, these four parameters. Everything else is dictated by the fact that you had to, for quantum mechanical unitarity, have very specific relationships between the representations that fields appear in and their couplings that they can have with gauge fields. And the other thing that we observe is we observe that there's no way of pairing up any of these objects. So to pair things up to get a mass term, you have to have some field in its complex conjugate. Nothing, no field here is a complex conjugate of any of the other fields. There's no way to form mass. And so the first observation you say is that there's no masses allowed, which is weird since we actually know that particles have mass. So no mass is allowed if all I do is write down these spin 1/2 file fermions. So at this point, we have just three parameters, or four parameters if you allow me to include gravity. And you may have heard that the standard model has 19 parameters, or 20 if you allow myself to have gravity in there. So where are the remaining 16 parameters? They must be someplace, and obviously I've left some room down here to explain where they're going to come from. But I want you just to meditate and contemplate this fact, that at this point, we have beautiful, elegant mathematical structures, the structure of GR, the structure of gauge theories. This is where I learned to fall in love with the standard model, seeing this table. And then the next thing that I learned made me vomit a little bit in my mouth. And, you know, it's a big problem. It's a big problem of finding out where masses come from. But it's ugly, the way that those masses are realized. So, for example, of these 16 parameters, what are they? The remaining 16 parameters. We have 9 fermion masses. I haven't told you where these masses are going to come from. But you have to specify, for example, the mass of the electron, the mass of the muon, the mass of the tau lepton, the mass of the up quark, the down quark, the strange quark, down quark, strange quark, charm quark, bottom quark, top quark. Okay, we've got the rest of them. That's 9. We have 3 mixing angles. These are mixing angles that let quark flavors rotate into each other. We have 2 CP violating phases. And again, at this point, you don't see where these are all coming from. One of these CP violating phases is associated with the strong CP problem. And then, if I count up to 16, 9 plus 3 plus 2 gets me to 14, so there's 2 more parameters to go. And these 2 more parameters are associated with the field that I haven't yet mentioned, which is also implicated in all these additional parameters that I can write down. We have 1 boson mass. Okay, which boson? Spoiler alert, the Higgs boson. And 1 boson vacuum expectation value. Which boson? Again, the Higgs boson. And so in order to have the observed structure of masses that we see in the standard model, you have to the best of our knowledge, incorporate something that has the quantum numbers of a spin zero field. And until we discovered the Higgs boson, we didn't know whether that spin zero object was fundamental, whether it was composite. Now we seem to believe, to a good approximation, that it's fundamental. This spin zero degree of freedom, and the spin zero degree of freedom is the Higgs boson. This is a complex field, so oftentimes it's helpful to also write down the conjugate, Higgs dagger field. This is a doublet under SU2 left. It's a conjugate doublet, which actually is the same as a doublet in terms of being isomorphic. It doesn't carry any color charge, and it has this funny hypercharge assignments of minus and plus a half. And this is a complex doublet. So 1, 2, complex conjugate, 3, 4. So we have 4 spin zero degrees of freedom. And the standard model complications are basically all associated with the dynamics and the couplings of those 4 real spin zero degrees of freedom. And once I specify this, we'll be able to use the rules of the standard model as an effective field theory to actually write down all the interactions that we want. Though I'm actually going to not go into excruciating detail on this in interest of time. But let me just pause here to see if there's any complaints, any questions, opinions, whether you think this is actually beautiful and not vomitous. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, you mentioned there's no reason to believe there are exactly 3 generations of all of these. Is there a reason to believe that there is the same number of generations of leptons versus quarks?
Good. So the question was, we have 3 generations of fermions, 3 times 15. Why not 4? Why not 20? And there's no reason to believe that you couldn't have more generations. And in fact, there's constraints and bounds on the existence of other generations. So that experimentally, we know that it's 3. But it is true that if you look at this structure here, it does have to come in structures that look like this because of something called gauge anomalies. So as I mentioned, you really need to make sure that your spin one degree of freedom is massless. And if you don't make sure that your fermion content is just right, then you'll radiatively generate a mass. So if you really want a massless spin one degree of freedom, you have to make sure you satisfy what are known as anomaly cancellation conditions. And it means that you can't really break this structure up. So I can't change some numbers in this table without violating the anomaly cancellation conditions. So that's a quantum constraint that we have on the fermion content that explains to us why, for example, this part and this part, there has to be the same number of those degrees of freedom.
Neutrinos?
Neutrinos will come in the next part of my talk.
Okay, good. But I wanted to actually, first thing, you know, generally about, you know, neutrinos. Yeah. But then in addition, so if there are sterile neutrinos, does it mean there's also some sort of new charge fermion that is kind of paired with it?
Good. So when you say the word sterile neutrino, it can mean any number of different things. So if you hear the word, if you hear the word sterile neutrino, everyone in their brain should say sterile neutrino. Oh, that could be a Goldsteino. That could be an Axino. That could be basically any type of vile spin a half fermion that doesn't really carry any charges. So if I had some kind of sterile neutrino, basically, it's something that's zero, nothing, nothing. But that actually includes a bunch of things that don't even have the name of neutrino. So the fact that it's a neutrino is because we think that this object might interact with this one, but actually just some neutral fermion, of which, like some of my colleagues say, oh, I don't like those people who are doing sterile neutrino model building. And I say, yeah, but you're working on Axinos or Photinos, which have the same quantum numbers. And the phenomenological implications could be similar just because you're talking about something that has this charges. But it does not necessarily mean that I have a conduit or a companion charged fermion. Okay. It could be totally separate. Yeah. Indeed, that's what people usually mean when they say sterile neutrino. Sterile in part because it does not participate under the SU2 interaction. Yeah.
Yeah. Hello. I've heard statements along the lines that, like you said, okay, we think the Higgs is elementary. And I've heard statements along the lines of, because the top mass is heavier than the Higgs mass, that if the Higgs were composite at some large scale, that would affect Higgs top couplings. But I don't know what these statements mean. Are those statements true? Can you explain?
Okay, so the question was, how confident are we that the Higgs is an elementary field? And I would say that already in the LEP era, we had strong evidence that the Higgs was elementary-ish. because we didn't see large deviations in precision electroweak measurements. Whereas if it were composite, you would have thought that there should be some deviations. Then you can say, well, maybe the Higgs is elementary-ish in the same way that the pion is elementary-ish. The pion is light compared to the proton. And it basically kind of looks like an elementary particle until you go up an order of magnitude in energy. And so maybe the Higgs is a composite state in the same sense of like a Goldstone boson like the pion. That's what I worked on when I was a graduate student. And indeed, you can have all sorts of fun things that allow the Higgs to be composite, allow the top to be partially composite, and be completely consistent with experimental observations at the time that when I was a grad student. Now that type of scenario is under tension. Because you would have expected to start to see evidence for the rest of those composite states, in particular composite states that have quantum numbers similar to the top quark. And then, you know, if I were, giving a talk trying to tell you about all the ways of weaseling out of issues having to do with experimental bounds and still resolve the hierarchy problem, I could tell you how you could have dark color fields that are in some Z2 symmetry with regular color fields, and that's how we can be in a situation where the top partners actually don't carry color. And there's like all sorts of subtleties and things that you can go on to. But generically, we expect that the Higgs and top could have been composite, and it may indeed be kind of partially composite, but we would have seen deviations, for example, in Higgs top-top interactions that we haven't seen yet. But also the bounds are not that stringent yet, which is why people are, for example, excited about doing Higgs factory studies.
Just intuitively, is there some easy way to understand where the deviations in the precision electroweak parameters would be coming from? Is it because the models where you get this, you also have other composite states at nearby scales, and so you expect that it's these new degrees of freedom that are near the Higgs mass that would be doing this?
So let me not get into the total weeds of this, but roughly speaking, you can write down dimension six operators that change the propagator that would have been suppressed by just the weak scale, basically. And we don't see evidence of that. We see a gap or a little hierarchy between electroweak physics and what's above it. So we don't see deviations from the propagator. For example, one of the stringent constraints comes from the fact that the W and Z boson seem to be really related to each other. And there's something called the T parameter that would be given a distortion that we don't see that much evidence for.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Okay. So where are we now? I'll leave this up here. We have the ingredients, but we don't know the implications. And you know, what's kind of amazing about thinking about the standard model as an effective field theory is that once you have the ingredients and you trust the principles of quantum mechanics, locality, unitarity, and so on and so forth, then you can write down all possible interactions consistent with what you know. And that would then be the predictions of the standard model in my way of telling things. So in my way of telling things, I tell you the ingredients, these gauge fields, these fermions, these bosons. Now write down all interactions consistent with what we know, consistent with Lorentz symmetry, consistent with unitarity. And that would give you the implications. So this is basically saying that ingredients tell you the implications. And getting to Giorgio's question, we're going to see that one of the implications of these ingredients is the existence of neutrino masses that goes beyond the 19 canonical parameters that we talk about. We'll have additional parameters that will show up when we think about the standard model as an effective field theory. And so, as I said many times, the standard model deserves more than 2 hours. But let's start with the part of the standard model that is so absolutely basic that it's hard for me to ignore, and that is the vacuum structure of the standard model. You know, what does a standard model look like if you have no excitations, just the vacuum? So one thing that we know in terms of the vacuum structure is that the potential, or the Hamiltonian, its expectation value apparently is non-zero. And we have no idea why our universe is accelerating, but it can be described in terms of a vacuum structure that has a non-trivial cosmological constant, or non-trivial vacuum expectation value. So this is a cosmological constant. Um, And that's an apparent fact about our vacuum, which is confusing. And I would say that this is something that can be accommodated in the standard model, but not entirely accommodated by the rules that I told you before, because this causes our universe to be asymptotically de Sitter, whereas I talked about our universe as having Lorentz and Poincaré symmetry. So this is, in some sense, for me, like starting to break some of the principled logic that I use to build these lectures. This Higgs scalar, it's a boson, and it can get a non-trivial vacuum expectation value. So the operator H dagger H, that can get an expectation value, and it does. And we call that the electroweak vacuum expectation value. And this causes electroweak symmetry breaking, which we're going to talk about more when we talk about the Higgs mechanism. Once we have electroweak symmetry breaking, then these doublet structures get broken apart. And one of the things that we know is that the fermions that experience the strong force confines. And the way that they confine is a way that we actually get non-trivial vacuum expectation values for ups and down quarks that have a value that we call lambda QCD, roughly speaking. There's factors of 4 pi that I'm dropping. And this leads to the things that I study a lot in my research, QCD confinement, and what's known as chiral symmetry breaking. And the vacuum structure of our universe is rich, it's complicated, and in some sense, the deepest mysteries of the standard model are associated with this vacuum structure. So in particular, if I just write these all in terms of dimensionful scales, then we have the Planck scale, which is much, much bigger than the electroweak scale, which is, well, bigger, but almost the same size as the QCD confinement scale, which itself is much, much bigger than the scale associated with the cosmological constant. And just in the way that I've written it right now, it's maybe not so obvious why these scales are or are not the same or different. So if you want to say like my degree of happiness with these various scales and these, you know, greater than symbols, this one is associated with a problem that we call the hierarchy problem. Why is there a huge hierarchy of scales between these? And so this makes me unhappy. But this hierarchy between the QCD confinement scale and M Planck, somehow you don't hear about that and people don't complain about it. Why not? Because in the context of the SU3 gauge theory, there's a slow process that's called dimensional transmutation, which allows you to get exponentially large hierarchies of scales. And so this one makes me feel happy. And if you were born in a different generation, then you would say, ooh, this thing makes me feel happy. Maybe I can take my happiness and transfer it over here. And so if you've heard people talk about Technicolor is trying to take this dimensional transmutation argument and try to apply it to the hierarchy problem, which unfortunately, to the best of our knowledge, doesn't work. But it's a way of taking one happiness and trying to apply it everywhere. And then if we want to be like super unhappy and you want to stay up at night, then you dream or have nightmares about the cosmological constant problem. And so this is like super unhappy and I'm pulling my hair out, what little of it I have left. And it's not at all clear why is this hierarchy of scales not a problem and these other two are huge problems? And this is, in some sense, one of the deepest mysteries that we have in the standard model as that fact. Okay. But this is the vacuum structure of the standard model. And everything we're going to talk about follows on top of this vacuum structure. If I had a whole more time, I would have talked about QCD and confinement and this process of jet formation, which is part of my research program. I have nothing intelligent to say about the cosmological constant problem, like zero. That was one of the questions that I got at my PhD qualifying exam from my mother. and she was very disappointed in me that I did not have a solution to that particular problem. We're going to focus on this vacuum structure, the electroweak symmetry breaking structure, which is crucial to understanding a variety of phenomena. And I'll focus on here on masses. So let me just pause here to see if there's any questions about the vacuum structure of the standard model. Question way in the back.
Hi. So given that you included the QCD, lambda QCD and confinement there in chiral symmetry breaking, would you say that under the way you tell the story now, we can include phase transitions there, like hadron degrees of freedom, you know, coexisting with parton degrees of freedom, and then somehow this phase transition story that is told on the side now can be like included in this picture?
Good. This is actually a fascinating debate that people have. And when we talk about physics beyond the standard model, it's a fascinating question what we mean by the standard model. It is certainly true that the dynamics of QCD confinement and chiral symmetry breaking is something that we think follows from the standard model. But confinement has been so confusing, and we don't actually know how to predict it very well, that at some level that's physics not beyond the standard model, but beyond our current capabilities to do calculations within the standard model. And so if someone could tell me the real-time dynamics of how confinement and chiral symmetry breaking and hadronization all works, I think that would be incredible. And I think I would add that to the list of things that I would like to accomplish before I die, is to understand there really is this phase transition. And if you want, during the coffee break, I can show you a plot that we've made, which actually images this phase transition in the same way that a condensed matter physicist would image like a break in scaling behavior. And that for me is really great for describing what's going on, but doesn't explain the real intrinsic dynamics of confinement. So I would add confinement as like a big thing that our field should be wanting to own and tackle and really dive into strong dynamics, both in QCD, but also other strongly coupled theories. Question? did the microphone pop up? No.
This is super short. So just the higher mass quarks, like the top, the bottom, do they also get like QCD condensate like this?
Good. So it's... So I think formally, yes, because they all mix. I haven't thought about it in detail. So it's confusing. So when you have a field that gets a vacuum expectation value, then you have goldstones associated with that symmetry breaking. But it's confusing, especially for the case of the top quark, because the top quark is even heavier than the electroweak scale. So, but I think formally you would say that it does have an expectation value, though I actually don't know what its value is. There's no reason it shouldn't have a vacuum expectation value. But I actually don't know how it scales.
Thank you.
Would you say the cosmological constant is another parameter we need?
Good. So maybe the standard model has 21 parameters. Yeah. If I allow G Newton for gravity and the cosmological constant for 21, there you go. Okay. The reason why I'm a little bit dodging that is because I started off with Lorentz invariants and Poincaré, and I don't want to do the representation theory of De Sitter space. But if you really wanted me to do the representation theory of De Sitter space, then that curvature would be something that I could add. But we're doing the representation theory of Poincaré, which is why I'm not including it, and just sheepishly kind of going behind the podium and trying to avoid answering that question. But yeah, let's say it's 21 parameters. If that makes me, feel pretty good. Yeah. Okay. So let's dive into this vacuum structure in just a little bit more detail. And again, I could go into much, much more detail, but I want to at least clear something up about something that confused me when I was a student. And it's just about counting degrees of freedom. Because we talk about the Higgs, and we say the word Higgs, we mean like many different things. So there's the Higgs boson. There's the Higgs field. There's the Higgs bev. And the one that somehow my family thinks is the most impressive sounding, my family thinks, ooh, Jesse, you study the Higgs mechanism. That sounds sexy. So the mechanism, okay, that's just, I don't know, that's whatever it is. Vev is just a number. The field has four, or it exists in four or three plus one dimensions. It exists in three plus, both of these things, the boson and the field, live in three plus one dimensions, and they can vary. But the field has 4 degrees of freedom, whereas the propagating polarization of the Higgs boson is just one. And it was always confusing to me the difference between one and four, so I want to just make sure that that's crystal clear, just in terms of counting things. We've been doing a lot of things by counting, you know, 15 and such. So how do I get from the Higgs field, which has 4 real degrees of freedom, that's what I wrote down right now, but we don't discover 4 Higgs bosons, right? We only talk about the one Higgs boson, so how do we get the difference between 1 and 4? So that's one of the things that I want to make sure that I explain. Okay. So I told you that the Higgs gets a vacuum expectation value. And with abusive notation, and apologies for people who like to write gauge invariant operators, I can write this Higgs field. It's a doublet. It has two components. And we're going to work in a basis where the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs is in the lower component. But this Higgs is charged under these gauge fields, charged under SU2 left cross U1. So we have an SU2 left cross U1 interaction that is broken. That is, I can't perform this rotation. I've spontaneously chosen a direction. I've had spontaneous symmetry breaking. And because the Higgs carries charge both under hypercharge on SU2 left, that means that this gauge symmetry that I started off with is broken. It's reduced down to the thing that we call U1 electromagnetism. And you know, when people talk about electroweak theory and they contrast electroweak theory from just electromagnetism, there's no real way of taking the standard model SU2 left cross U1 and finding out where ENM is. It's a linear combination of these. And in particular, if you take the generator of hypercharge and add to it the Pauli sigma 3 matrix, or T3, this is the combination that is unbroken, and all fields will have a charge under that combination. So in particular, let me just write this down right now. We're going to take my table and mangle it. So we're going to spontaneously break U1 hypercharge and SU2 left, break it down to U1 electromagnetic. And then at low energies, we can now break up this doublet. We'll ignore this Higgs bosons for a moment. And then what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to take the hypercharge and we add a half for the upper guy and subtract a half for the, we subtract a half for the, which way does it go? Did I do this backwards again? Which way do I do it? Maybe it's a minus. I thought I got my signs right. It's plus or minus. I forget which way it goes, sorry. I promised myself I would never make this mistake ever again in my career, and I seem to have done it. That minus sign drives me nuts. I thought I figured it out last night. Okay, so we have plus one, minus one, zero, plus two-thirds, minus a third, minus two-thirds, plus... Now I'm sweating and nervous. Okay, and then still the stuff stays on charge. Okay. And so after electroweak symmetry breaking, you see that certain things are allowed to happen. Now you see that fields come in conjugate pairs. So here, the electron in this conjugate pair, well, now they're actually conjugate pairs. And that means that we can have a Dirac mass for the electron. And this is one of the parameters of the standard model is telling me what that Dirac mass is. Same thing with the up quarks and its conjugate pair. They can get a Dirac mass. Same thing for the down quarks. We have a Dirac mass. And then we have a choice. We can either say that, the neutrino is self-conjugate to itself. Therefore, it can pair up with itself and now make a Majorana mass. And for me, this is what I would call the default. And this is why I'm super excited about neutrinoless double beta decay experiments. Or you would say, well, maybe there's some extra neutrino-like stuff up here. And maybe actually you're supposed to pair it this way. And you know, basically add this totally superfluous, completely irrelevant, has no place in the standard model, but some people like to put it in there anyway, field that would give me a Dirac mass. And as I'll try to explain to you in a bit, this default is super satisfying because it gives you a prediction that can be tested. Yeah. Okay, so that's what happens with the fermions. What happens with the bosons? Okay, so recall that we have these spin one bosons. And there were 12 of them, but 8 of them stay nice and happy in their SU3. Those gluons, they don't experience anything. They don't care at all about the electroweak symmetry breaking. So we have 4 remaining fields. And because they started off their life as massless, they have two helicities each. And I'm going to specify them in terms of their charge here. So the hypercharge gauge boson carries no charge. And then the W bosons, there's one that's positively charged, one that's negatively charged, and one that's neutral. And this structure comes from the fact that SU2, I said that it was an adjoint representation for the gauge fields. And when you work out the T3-ness, what that looks like for the adjoint representation, you have a plus one charge, a minus one charge, and a zero charge. And then we have the spin zero bosons. And again, these are real degrees of freedom, so these correspond to one mode each. So I'm going to give them these symbols. We have H0 and phi 0, phi plus, phi minus. And again, these charges are coming from these states down here. So we had minus a half, and we do our plus or minus the a half things because of the Pauli matrix. And we do that here and here, and that gives rise to two neutral guys, one positive and one negative. And then you stare at those things, and you say, well, just because of notation, this thing must be the thing that I call the Higgs boson. And indeed, this is the thing that weighs in at 125 GeV. This is the thing that we call the Higgs boson. And then what about the rest of this stuff? There's three other Higgs bosons, or three other remnants of the Higgs field. And what happens to them? Well, what happens to them is that these fields up here started their life off as massless with two helicities. But remember, spin one degrees of freedom, when they're massive, they have three polarizations. M is plus one, zero, and minus one. So this combination comes together to form the W plus boson. This combination forms together to form the W minus boson. Some linearly combination of these things becomes the Z boson. But I have too many degrees of freedom, so I do a diagonalization, and then the orthogonal direction is the massless photon. And so it was actually really crucial that the Higgs field had 4 degrees of freedom, one of which we see is the Higgs boson. And the other one we've already measured, and they turn into longitudinal polarization, or the, roughly speaking, the M equals zero polarization of the spin one, W and Z bosons. And so I'm not going through any of the mathematics about how the Higgs mechanism works, but this at least gives you the sense of the degree of freedom counting, and explains that if you want to replace the Higgs mechanism with something like the Higgs mechanism, but you don't want to use this doublet, nevertheless, you're going to have to make sure that you have, at minimum, these degrees of freedom, to have the mismatch between massless things that exist at high scales and then the massive bosons that exist at lower scales. And then for the experts, if you want to unitarize longitudinal gauge boson scattering, then you need to have something like the Higgs multiplet or the Higgs boson in order to unitarize, for example, WW longitudinal scattering. Okay. So that's what I wanted to tell you about the Higgs mechanism, done with boxes and without equations. So hopefully you at least can see how the degrees of freedom go around. Let me see if there's any questions before I then close out with thinking about the standard model as an effective field theory.
Could you possibly explain what we mean by all of this, meaning that the Higgs mechanism generates mass?
Good. So you're saying, why do I say that the Higgs mechanism generates mass? If the Higgs didn't get a vacuum expectation value, then there are no masses for anything. There's no way of pairing up the fermions. And then these gauge bosons, as we learned, if the symmetry is preserved, then they're going to be, if the gauge symmetry is preserved, they're going to be massless spin 1 degrees of freedom. So you need to have some vacuum expectation value to at least allow masses to exist. So that's the sense in which the mechanism tells me that masses are allowed. Now, the more detailed question is, what's the specific value of those masses? And just because masses are allowed doesn't mean that you necessarily know the value of them. And indeed, you can write down totally bizarro structures that allow for really weird relationships between masses and couplings. But the default Higgs mechanism not only say that masses are allowed, but by default, we say that the coupling of the Higgs boson to a field is related to the mass. Okay. So somehow I lost my eraser. Yes. So for example, let's take my favorite, my favorite elementary field is the top quark. My favorite composite field is the pion, because I love Goldstone bosons. But my favorite elementary field is the top quark. And the top quark, via the rules that we had before, allowed an interaction between the third generation quark doublet, the Higgs boson, and the conjugate top field. And this looks like a scattering process. And this coupling here is known as the Top-Yukawa coupling. So there's a scattering process that involves this Higgs doublet. But if this Higgs boson gets a vacuum expectation value, similar to like if you have an experiment and you turn on a background magnetic field, now this actually changes the way that this thing propagates. And this thing propagates in a way that the mass of the top quark is basically proportional to the coupling of the top quark times that electroweak bev. Similarly, if we have gauge bosons, so we have Higgs interaction. Again, this is now a, now I'm getting myself confused. I need to have, for the W, I guess I need to have, two of these. One or two of these. Can someone help me who remembers? Two Higgs, thank you. Okay, and this coupling here that involves two Higgses, it's two couplings, so it's G squared, and this turns down to a massive propagation. So this is saying that the W mass squared is proportional to the electroweak coupling squared times the Higgs bev squared. And if I take square roots, you'll see again, the mass is a coupling times the bev. So it's basically saying like you have, just like you have a background magnetic field that changes the propagation of other states. Like in the case of an axion, a background magnetic field allows an axion to convert into electromagnetic state, changes this propagation. Here, the background Higgs field changes the way that these fields propagate. And that's the way that we say that couplings are related to mass. Now, if you're super perverse, you would say, oh, I want to break these relationships. I want to not have the top quark mass be related to its coupling. And you can do it. You can say, I'm going to do something totally crazy. I'm going to introduce a crazy coupling. Okay, where I'm going to, this is totally consistent with everything that I know. I'm going to take this interaction and add three Higgs doublets coming in so that I can get three BEVs. And then I have a contribution to the mass that's proportional to the electroweak BEV cubed and not to the first power. And then to make this work out by dimensionality, there has to be some other cutoff scale squared. And then you can start playing funny games with this thing and try to make a deviation between the coupling of the top quark and its mass generation. That's a perverse thing to do, but that's also what people look for. So one of the things that people talk about when they're testing the standard model as an effective theory is they're testing this relationship and asking, is there any evidence for this crazy coupling that has top quarks coupling not just to two, not just to one Higgs doublet, but to three at the same time? That to start to get to answering your question? Okay. Other questions before I close things out by talking about the standard model as an effective theory? Okay, so before I do that, I stopped the story at the electroweak BEV. If I kept going down in scales, we'd eventually hit the QCD phase transition. Eventually, SU3 would confine. Eventually, you get this whole rich zoo of composite states obtained by taking those gluons and attaching them to various combinations of quarks that forms baryons and mesons, of which your favorite baryon is apparently from the previous lecture, is the neutron. So the neutron is a composite state that comes from binding together two down quarks and up quark together with glue. Eventually, those baryons form nuclei. They bind to the electromagnetic interaction to make atoms. Atoms combine to make molecules. Molecules do their chemistry thing. And then eventually you get to, you know, us as biological creatures. But one of the things that I hope you can get from this presentation thus far is that most of the complexity of the standard model is enabled by or facilitated by the spin zero Higgs boson. If it weren't for the Higgs boson, we wouldn't be able to write down the masses that we wrote down before. If it weren't for the Higgs boson, we wouldn't have these 16 extra couplings to contend with. The elegance of the standard model is associated with those degrees of freedom, the massless spin one and spin two fields, for which we don't actually have that much freedom, for which quantum mechanical principles actually locks in their structure, and I don't get to change those interactions. Whereas for the Higgs, I can do crazy things like introduce funny couplings like this and not violate any other principles, at least not ones that we've developed thus far. Okay, so I will erase all the board, and if there's any further questions, please interrupt me while I'm erasing. By directed field masses. Okay. Okay. Standard model as an effective field theory. So the cartoon version of my view is that everything consistent with the core principles of quantum mechanics and quantum field theory should be assumed to occur unless you can show either experimentally or theoretically that it does not. Moreover, the expected size of the effects should follow through from effective field theory scaling. And if the observed size experimentally does not, then you're probably missing a principle or paradigm. And this point of view changes the types of things that I think about in my own research and the types of things that I find puzzling. And you know, different people have different perspectives on what one should do research-wise. Anyway, that's my perspective. So basically, if it can happen, it does. But if it doesn't, there's probably a reason. You know, and whether this logic actually leads you to enlightenment or not is not so clear. But the hope is that, you know, by looking at these things, that we might, for example, you know, reveal a new principle or paradigm. So an example of this logic at work is why people get so, let's say, frustrated by the hierarchy problem, is that, you know, the hierarchy problem, I said it was that H dagger H has a vacuum expectation value of V electric squared. But there's no symmetry that keeps me from writing this down. And so what stops me from writing things down to kind of the natural scale in the problem, which if you think that you couple to gravity, the natural scale in the problem would be something like the Planck scale. Oh, which is not the Planck scale. And that mismatch, the fact that you don't see something of the observed size, means there's probably a reason in my way of thinking about things. And so, you know, one reason, for example, are ideas like supersymmetry, which is a reason to expect, or a way of explaining why you can have a vacuum expectation value that's much smaller than the purported fundamental scale in the theory. But that's an example of something where we are hunting for a principle or a paradigm to explain this mismatch, and this is the hierarchy problem. Sadly, I don't have anything intelligent to say about its current solution, because then if you follow this logic, when you introduce a new principle and paradigm, oftentimes you need to have new particle content. And in the case of supersymmetry, we don't currently have evidence for those fields that are involved in that paradigm, but though maybe one could hope that in my lifetime, R.C. Savas and Savas's lifetime, such those degrees of freedom could be discovered. Okay, so this is one example, the example of the hierarchy problem. Okay, so I said before, my favorite particle is the top quark. Not just because I spent a lot of my graduate student days thinking about the top quark. The top quark has a mass. If I write down it in the Lagrangian, we have a coupling of T with its conjugate field. Then I put a mass at the top there. Okay, what should be the expected size of that top quark mass? Well, this interaction breaks electroweak symmetry. And we wrote down the interaction before. In the standard model, we have a Yukawa coupling. This is one of those 19 parameters that tells you that I have a quark interacting with the H dagger field CC. But because it breaks electroweak symmetry, we expect that the top quark mass should be related to that scale where that symmetry is broken, to the electroweak scale, electroweak symmetry breaking scale. So what are these numbers? In the case of the top quark, its current mass is something like 173 GeV. Depending on your definition of the electroweak VeV, the most canonical way that we talk about it is 246 GeV. These things are close. This works. And following the logic that I had before, the fact that you have kind of order one-ish couplings means, yeah, probably, in terms of the standard model as an effective theory, the top quark satisfies my expectation about what its naive size should be based on saying, well, there probably are no, you know, weird small numbers that are not there for some reason. By contrast, what about the electron mass? So the electron mass comes from a similar type of interaction. This also breaks electroweak symmetry. Therefore, I need to invoke the Higgs mechanism. So I would write down an interaction lambda E L H E C. And therefore, my expectation is that the electron mass should be comparable to the electroweak symmetry breaking scale. The electron mass in GeV units is 0.000511 GeV, which is not really that similar to 246 GeV. And it's uncomfortable, the electron mass being small. It's uncomfortable. Why is it so small? It's radiatively stable, so if I take my electron mass, that is, I have my Higgs interaction here with my Higgs coupling to my electron, and I start like dressing things up with all sorts of loopy stuff, you can show that the radiative corrections to the mass don't give you a distortion from this mass value. So that's what sometimes people call as being technically natural. But, you know, for anyone who's been pulled over for driving too fast, you know, trying to argue with a police officer that technically maybe you didn't break the law or something like that, you know, you should feel uncomfortable about that. And so this suggests that maybe there's actually a mechanism or a reason why the electron mass is so much smaller than the electroweak scale. Maybe there's some other feature, paradigm, principle that explains that mismatch. Okay. So now I'm going to say something that for some of you, you will cheer and joy, and other people will question my sanity. So again, let's just see the scorecard here. The scorecard here is heavy fields like the top quark, that makes sense. Big mass, that makes sense. Mass close to the electroweak scale, that makes sense in my logic. Electron masses, that's really confusing. The smallest mass for a fermion that we know about is the neutrino mass. Do I view the neutrino mass as being kind of expected or not based on this effective field theory logic? Like how confident am I that the neutrino mass might be a harbinger of some like deep new principle? Okay, so let's take as the example Majorana and neutrino masses. Yeah.
Can you elaborate a little bit more on this intuition you want to put forward about technically natural things? Like the electroweak symmetry is broken. The electroweak symmetry is broken at a scale.
Yeah. And
someone would have said, you know, okay, the electron has some chiral symmetry. That chiral symmetry is broken at some scale. There's no reason that these two scales need to be similar. I understand that I think you have some intuition maybe coming from these, continuous global symmetry things, but I still don't understand why I should, in any ballpark, expect that these scales should be similar. Like, why should I complain if those scales are wildly different?
Good. Okay. So this is an open question. So the question is, you know, why am I making a big deal here? Because when I was growing up, I was told, oh, this thing, technically natural, means that if I take the electron mass and I send it to zero, we have an enhanced symmetry. And you say it's a chiral symmetry. So this gives me an enhanced chiral symmetry. But this is an enhanced chiral symmetry, and this is a global symmetry. And it is an kind of outstanding question that we don't really know the answer to about how we should think about global symmetries or even approximate global symmetries in a theory of quantum gravity. The quantum field theory perspective would be set it and forget it. Set it to some value, calculate its radiative corrections. As long as you have something that's under perturbative control, then you're totally fine. And I spent most of my life being comfortable with that perspective. Then people started talking about, well, maybe global symmetries don't exist. Maybe I have to worry that, for example, running around in loops, there's some kind of quantum gravity muck that would try to drag anything that seemed to be preserving a symmetry and kind of drag it away from the symmetry protected limit. And in that context, maybe I should be skeptical about the existence of that chiral symmetry. And maybe that's actually a hint about something about the flavor structure of the standard model. It's all reversed from the way that I did my own model building in the past. In the past, I would work really hard to get the top quark to be the mass that it was, expecting that the standard thing was that it was small. And so I did all my flavor model building like in this world. But now I'm wondering whether it's the other way around, whether actually we're getting some hint about my friends, keep yelling at me over and over again, there's no global symmetries and no global symmetries in quantum gravity, that maybe I should be more nervous. But it's a nervousness that's not tied to anything deep. It's a nervousness that's coming from questioning at this age in my life, what are the things that I've been told about and what can I maintain or what do I need to shift around in terms of what principles and paradigms I think describe our universe. Does that give you some sense?
Thank you.
Yeah. Also, I'm just doing this in part just to have fun because, you know, getting a chance to come to the Perimeter Institute, I feel like, you know, at the Perimeter Institute, this is the place where if you have a crazy idea, you should be free to say it and then have people attack you at lunch. You know, so I think this is the place for me to give this emerging point of view. Okay, so Majorana and neutrino masses. Let me just write it down. Neutrino and itself with a Majorana mass. Okay, you can't just do that based on the principles that we know. This breaks electric symmetry. In fact, it breaks electric symmetry twice. So if I were to write this in terms of an operator, I'd have to take LH and write it again, LH. And so this thing is proportional to two copies of the electric VeV. So my estimate of the neutrino mass from this logic is saying that it's the electric scale squared divided by some fundamental scale that I don't know, just by dimensional analysis, let me call it lambda nu, some new scale. Well, maybe this new scale is actually just some quantum gravity stuff living at the Planck scale. So if you do that, so this Planck scale, roughly speaking, depending on you're talking about the regular or the reduced Planck mass, this is an 10 to the 18 GeV. You put in the 256 GeV, and then you ask, what is the estimate for what the Majorana neutrino mass should be? The estimate of the Majorana neutrino mass would be 10 to the minus 13 GeV from this logic. And the current observed bound on the absolute neutrino mass is around 10 to the minus 10 GeV. And these numbers are close. Surprisingly close. And in fact, if you just thought that maybe there's a couple of factors of 4 pi running around, or maybe the fundamental scale is not the Planck scale, but something a little bit lower, like your expectation, I would say, my expectation is that the standard model wants to have Majorana neutrino masses by writing down this effective field theory logic. And it would be nutso if someone said, oh no, what it really is a Dirac neutrino mass, where I had to put some tiny little mass in front of it. That's weird. This is the natural thing to happen. And so, okay, we can argue about what exactly the physics is that's happening at this scale, but this is why I think the neutrinoless double beta decay is one of the most important measurements that we should be doing, because we think it's going to be there. We think that there's going to be violation of lepton number by 2 units, because what's keeping me from doing it? what's keeping me from writing this down. This is my expectation based on, again, this standard model as an effective field theory. So in this telling, Majorana neutrino masses are expected. Dirac neutrino masses would be weird. And in fact, I'd totally change my perspective, this whole thing. If you told me that really there was Dirac neutrino masses, then I'd start to wonder whether small numbers are the natural thing and not big ones. Okay, so I have time for two more, hopefully. So I said I wasn't going to talk about the strong CP problem. I'm not really going to, but since we heard about the neutron electric dipole moment earlier today, let me just follow the same logic. In fact, this is exactly the same logic that you heard before, but let me just give it to you in my units or my notation system. So what do we think the EDM is for a neutron? What's our estimate of it based on this effective field theory logic? Well, there is a CP violating phase, one of those 19 parameters that I can put in there. I don't know, it has some order one-ish number probably. And the only other scale in the problem, if I'm talking about neutrons, is the, you know, the confinement scale, lambda QCD. And so lambda QCD inverse, that's be my expectation. This is on the order of the GEVs. What's my observed value? Observed value is, well, less than 10 to minus 10-ish. Of this number. This makes me uncomfortable. That's why I also think that there's probably some dynamical reason why the strong CP problem is solved. Either a new principle that explains why it's so small, or some dynamical mechanism like the axion that explains its smallness. This makes me feel uncomfortable, again, in the same way that the electron mass makes me feel uncomfortable and is crying out for an explanation. And the last one that I'll do is proton decay. Following what you've heard about thus far, I've not talked about baryon number or lepton number in these lectures for a reason, because nothing, okay, with an asterisk, but nothing forbids me from writing down an interaction that would take a proton, which is a bound state of two ups and a down quark, for it to decay to a positron. Nothing stops me from doing that. In the context of SU3, these are all three bars, but three bars come together can make something that is colorless. This violates baryon number by one unit, violates lepton number by one unit. But again, the absence of global symmetries, to the best of our knowledge, is not a principle. In fact, it might be required by quantum gravity that we actually don't have any global symmetries. And so now you can ask, okay, what is the expectation for proton decay? What is its rate? So this is a dimension 6 operator. It's suppressed by some scale squared, so I'm just saying like some proton decay scale, lambda p. And so the estimate for the proton lifetime following this EFT logic is that it's the amplitude squared, so lambda p squared, or inverse amplitude squared, divided by, well, what's the only other scale in the problem? It's a proton. Proton roughly has the size of lambda QCD-ish, strong confinement muck, lambda QCD. To the fifth. Should be something around this. Maybe the thing that generates this operator, maybe this is at the Planck scale. QCD, again, the scale is GeV. And if you put in the numbers, what do you get? You get 10 to the 72 GeV, or inverse GeV, rather, converting this into something that makes more sense, 10 to the 40 years. I view this as kind of a prediction of the standard model, your expectation for what the standard model wants to do, assuming that the fundamental scale is the Planck scale. What's the observed value of proton decay? Or, it's not observed, but what's the observed lifetime? It's greater than 10 to the 35 years, 34 years. And again, these numbers, given the high powers involved, these numbers are also surprisingly close. And if it weren't so expensive to build giant tanks of water to look for decaying protons, I would say that this is a target that we should want to hit. In some ways, the standard model is telling us that if it's only a theory that's valid up to the Planck scale, then we expect to see something like proton decay, maybe even see it at a lower scale with some other principle governing things. But these, you know, types of effective field theory logic kind of tell you, at least for me, kind of what things I think should or should not exist in the standard model, and is maybe different than the type of things that you might or might not have been expecting. Okay, so let me just wrap things up in 1 minute. So, as I said, the standard model deserves more than 2 hours, but you only got 2 hours of it, so there's many more things I can dive into. I hope I've given you at least some glimpse into the richness of this theory and some of the ways that I tackle it. Some of this theory is inevitable. Spin two, spin one. Some of it is confusing. Spin one, Higgs boson. But you know, hopefully this gives you some view of the principles and paradigms that we used to build the standard model, and maybe one of those things will be overturned sometime and we'll see what lies beyond it. Thanks very much.
So Jess, you seem to be selling this very last 10 seconds, the some sort of natural scale for the proton lifetime.
Yeah.
My impression is that in the past, this has been a little bit of a moving target, at least as an experimentalist. They said, no, just make it 10 times larger and you'll see it. And so where does that come? Okay, can you, is that, first of all, is that just my misperception, or there's been a moving target, and why the target moves?
Good. So it's not so much that the target is moving, it's that everyone knows this formula, so this thing should be to the fourth power. Everyone knows this formula, but it's sensitive to this scale, to the fourth power, and so small changes in where you think the new fundamental scale is have big changes on what the lifetime is. So if you thought this was the naive SU5 grand unification scale, or the supersymmetric grand unification scale, or the Planck scale, this thing moves around by something that changes these numbers. So the current bound, it's six orders of magnitude away, but that's only like 1.5 in terms of this scale. And so you actually don't have to move the scale very much. That's also is why this is such a painful thing to look for, because you have to scale up your tank of water by that power in order to get sensitivity to that scale. So you only get sensitivity that grows like the quarter power of your target mass. But I would say that generically, if you're an effective field theorist, you expect something like this. And then anyone who told you a lower number than this was hoping and praying that their idea was right. But like, this is the default explanation expectation. In the same way that if you look at neutrino masses, like this number is smaller than this one is smaller than what we see, which actually goes the other way. It says, ooh, that's exciting. Maybe there might be some deviation. And if you link this scale with this scale, then you get yourself really excited that proton decay could be just around the corner.
Okay, so I guess let's wrap up. Maybe like let's thank Jesse again, and we need to set up like